about the material that I've given you, we won't dive into it necessarily until next Wednesday, but I wanted to introduce it tonight and kind of get you headed in the right direction. Everybody should be looking at a book. At the top it says the Sermon on the Mount, and that's what we'll be studying over the next 3 months. We will be delving into Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. We want to get as good and familiar an understanding of that sermon as we can, and we really want to come up with a great list of practical ways to use Jesus' words. He was not just teaching generic doctrine. He was sharing things that brought disciples into fellowship with Him and was lived out in their choices every day. And that's what we want to talk about. And we're going to do it over the course of 3 months. What you have there on the sheet, on the cover, it says auditorium class. It should say Wednesday night. I neglected to add that. But this is a Wednesday night auditorium class. And we're going to do it for one quarter, 3 months. We're going to try to stick to the quarter system a little bit, which means that typically a Sunday class will be about 13 weeks and a Wednesday class will be about 13 weeks. And there are a few reasons why I like to do that. One is it's what I've been doing for 15 years, kind of used to it, I guess. It's a comfort zone a little bit. Also, I think it might be beneficial for the teachers. If you're planning on teaching next quarter, you'll finish this study completely and then you'll go back to those classes. And if somebody's back there teaching for a quarter, although I missed it by a week, they have one more class tonight. But when they come in here, they'll be able to start with something fresh. So that's a little bit of the reason behind that. And it also just helps keep me focused. I don't know what would happen in a class with no ending date. We would just continue to circle the point, maybe. But here we have to kind of zero in a little bit. So this material is designed, just to be clear, to give you something to study every week for the next 13 weeks or so. July, August, and September. It doesn't really lay out like a 13-lesson book. As you can see right there on the cover, it's really 8 lessons. What I've done is taken this familiar sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, and we all remember at least pieces of this, and tried to put it into 8 simple categories. Just to let you know, a challenge that I'll have for everybody in the room, and I believe we can all accomplish this, is by the end of this quarter, you are easily able to break down that entire sermon into these 8 sections. So something like the Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 13. When you think Beatitudes, you think be happy. When we're studying be salt, be light. Everybody remembers be salt of the earth and light of the world. You'll think be influential, Matthew 5, 13 through 16. There's a huge chunk in chapter 5 about you have heard, but I say to you, you recognize that language? About 6 or 7 of those, you have heard this is what righteousness looks like. I'm about to show you what righteousness looks like. So you'll remember section 3, be righteous. And so we'll go through them one at a time. It'll take about a week, week and a half for each one. But when we're done, it's a really great way to remember this. When you're studying something like fasting or prayer or giving, that section's titled be sincere. When you pray, pray with sincerity, not to be seen by others. When you fast, and we'll have some fun conversations about fasting. Should we be fasting today? Maybe. We'll be enjoying that study. Or when you're praying, or when you're giving, be sincere. So this is the kind of 8 little sections that we'll be working with, and we're really not diving into this till next week. So I'm giving it to you tonight. I want you to kind of get familiar with what we're looking at. I'll show you a little sample in the first couple of pages about how it works. When we get back in this room 1 week from tonight, we will turn into the first page and we will start working on be happy. Now let me just ask an open-ended question about the Sermon on the Mount that we all know so well. How long was that sermon? Now think about it. If you were there that day, you're sitting on the mountainside and Jesus says, I'm going to preach the best sermon that's ever been preached. I'm going to preach the sermon that will change the lives of disciples forever. And you sat down and He preached it. And Wayne and I will take note of your answers. The perfect sermon was about how long? How long do you guys think it was? You've read it before, right? Give me some guesses. 20 minutes? You wish. You might be right.
8 to 12 hours.
12-hour sermon? No upper rooms, no windows. All right. So we got short, long, any other guess? I mean, you've read it, right? Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Now, I would think that we probably read a little faster than it's preached. Does that make sense to say? When you're reading, you're really kind of, your eyes are just moving down the page. So if you were just going to read Matthew 5, 6, and 7, how long would that take? I don't know.
About
15 minutes? All right. Here's what I want you to do for next week. First of all, you don't have to say it out loud, but have a number in your head. How long was this sermon? Now, here's the sort of sub-assignment for next week. Read Matthew 5, 6, and 7. Start a little timer, a little clock, a little eye device, something. But read it as if it was being preached. You guys understand the difference? Read it out loud. Read it with pauses for dramatic effect. Read it with enough time between the sentences for the words to hit the hearer's ear. Just read it as if you were sitting there listening to Jesus preach it to you. First of all, that's a great exercise. Reading scripture out loud when Jesus is speaking and just hearing it coming at you is a really great way to read. But also, I'm kind of interested in the times. I think I know. And it, maybe it'll affect my preaching length, but probably not. But you'll see. But I want you to come next week and give me a number on how long was the Sermon on the Mount. 8 great ideas, and it's expressed here. Alright, a little bit more of what's on the cover page, so we're really familiar with this. I should say also that this is about usually what my material looks like. It's pages and a little comb right here. Special thanks to Helen Mercer, the secretary back at Dowling Road, who sneaked me out 100 of these before I left last week. And those are what you have in your hand there. We'll probably get us one of these little binder things this week and make sure we have plenty more going forward. But this is kind of what it'll look like. And near the bottom of the page it says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and he began to teach them, saying, I want to know what Jesus said. This sermon seems to be for people who are already disciples, but they do not yet understand what the kingdom was to be like. They already believed, but they did not fully understand what belief looks like in the way you live every day. Jesus said, I'm going to show you exactly who can be in my kingdom. I will describe for you the character traits and the attitude of kingdom citizens. And so here we are, believers, you and me. Believe in Jesus, we love him, we are in his kingdom, and we want to know what it means to be here. This sermon will be for us. There's a little paragraph at the bottom, just a little pep talk saying, don't give up, you know, work some of the stuff, put a little bit of time in on it, and hopefully it will be beneficial to you. Any questions or comments about this? Kind of what we have here. Wednesday night, quarter, 8 sections. Okay, open up to the first page. We won't delve into this, as I said a few minutes ago, but I just want you to be comfortable with kind of the way this works. Each page will have a little bit of stuff to read. I kind of set the stage for what's happening. I encourage you strongly, when you're getting ready to do a page, up at the top when it says Matthew 5, 1 through 12, go read that first. Read the text, hear Jesus, then go into the material a little bit. And we'll read a little bit, a paragraph or two. And then I've kind of tried to underline. When you see something underlined, that's me asking you a question, and you get to do some stuff. You don't have to do some stuff. You get to do some stuff. So the underline is you get to participate. So, for instance, about halfway down the page, on page 2, it says, let's investigate how the Beatitudes are accomplished in the Christian life. Let's begin by making 2 lists. So that will be your first thing you'll do this week. On the left, just list the actions. The poor in spirit, for instance. And on the right, the blessing. So if I'm looking at Matthew 5, for instance, I've got verse 3. Those who are poor in spirit, the blessings is theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Verse 4, there are those who mourn. We'll talk about what that means. But those who mourn shall be comforted. So on one side, you're making a list of the things that you will do. And on the other side, you're making a list of the things that God is going to do for you. So if you could take a look at that and write it down, you'll see where that goes. In some of the cases, I've tried to kind of do the first thing. You never know when you go somewhere new. Sometimes I've gone places where they're so used to material and questions and answers that my stuff just is beneath them. But sometimes when you're at a place where they're not used to material and they're not used to you, you ever notice how to the teacher the questions look perfect, but to the student it looks like another language? We're going to have to go through that together, okay? Where I'm going to write something and I'm going to think, that's just a really well-worded question. And somebody's going to call me and say, that's the worst question I think I've ever read. So what I've tried to do to kind of cope with that a little bit is do a little bit of it for you. So like at the bottom of page 2, all right, let's start with the list on the left. Choose 2 of the list on the left and just explain what it means. What is poor in spirit? What is those who mourn? Use at least 1 other Bible passage to help you out. So then I went ahead and did one. An example would be the poor in spirit. A poor spirit represents someone humble enough and honest enough with themselves to realize their sinfulness before God and the need for God in order to be made whole. And then I added, like David. David was that in Psalm 51. He just said, I'm a sinner. I'm a nobody. Please save me. Now, if you want to use that one as your first one, look, we just met. It's fine. But the idea is, I'll give you a little bit over here to get you started. You go pick two for yourself, okay? What would be really great next week is when we gather if all of them are represented in the room, you know? You picked one that somebody else didn't pick, and we'll do that. So that's a little bit about how this works. If you have any questions along the way, you can call me and we'll work on it. Or I hope to be up here. My plan is to be up here just about every weekday during the day. We can meet, talk about it, whatever you guys want to do. So that's what we're doing. Sunday morning is something totally different. We're going to be talking about personal evangelism. It doesn't have standardized material like this. It's all kinds of different interesting things we're going to try. So this will be your main material for the quarter. Write your name on it or something like that. All right, there we go. Any questions about that? Okay. I don't want to get in it tonight for two reasons, because we have teachers who are coming in next week, and also because you didn't get a chance to do anything yet, and then I'll end up filling in your blanks. So here's what we're going to do instead. I want to take a look at the book of Matthew in and of itself, the whole picture. The Sermon on the Mount is told in different forms and lengths in other places. Mark and Luke have allusions to it, little sections of it, snippets. But it's Matthew's gospel that gives you three whole chapters about this sermon. And I would say of all four gospels, the book of Matthew, which we'll talk about for the next few minutes, the gospel of Matthew is the most compartmentalized, sectioned letter of the four. He set out to do something clear, and he goes about it in a very methodical kind of way. Ultimately, what Matthew wants to do, he writes this letter in about 60 AD. He wants to prove who Jesus is. He wants to prove that Jesus is worthy of honor, and he's worthy to study, and he's worthy to be your king. Now, Mark does that, and Luke does that, and John does that. But Matthew uses a very structured approach that I want to show you tonight. We'll try to learn this along with learning the Sermon on the Mount. And I hope this will help you in your approach to Matthew. This book gets kind of skipped a lot for two reasons. You know, if you're going to read a New Testament letter, you think you'd start with Matthew, but a lot of times we don't. If you're going to study a gospel with somebody, we choose something other than Matthew. Two reasons. One, it's just too long. You know, Mark is only 16 chapters, right? And Luke is shorter and John is shorter. So sometimes the 28 chapters throw us off. And then when you're so determined that Matthew is the book for you, you open up to Matthew chapter 1 and you're really excited about reading it. And what's the first thing you find? Who likes read? Any genealogy lovers here? First of all, that's the hardest word in the English language to spell. You should try it. I've been trying. I typed it all afternoon. I finally had to look it up. There's an A in there. Genealogy. All right? We don't read it because of that, but here's what I want to show you. Go back to chapter 1. Matthew is doing something brilliant in this letter. The way that these 28 chapters lay out, and it starts with this genealogies. Let me just ask this question. Mark, Luke, John don't do this. Luke has a shorter genealogy in chapter 3. Why do you think Matthew opened his letter with this? Ties the Old Testament into what people waited for, she said. It's bridging the gap. It's showing the connection between old and new. Yes, ma'am?
He was writing to a Jewish Christian audience.
Okay, probably true. It's around 60 AD, let's say. The church is growing, and these Jews are constantly bombarded with this idea that you need to give up Jesus. He's not the true one. He's not the only one. And they're being encouraged to abandon him. That is familiar language for us today. Somehow this genealogy helps stop that. Let's investigate that. Yes?
He's just proving who Jesus is.
Okay.
By genealogy.
That's a tool of genealogy, is to prove who Jesus is. Yes, sir or ma'am? Which one was what? Was he?
Took
your point? Was that good, wasn't it? All the hands went down. Yes? Okay. When we can look at the names in the genealogy, we're instantly going to remember that God promised that guy something, and Jesus fulfilled that man's promise. God promised that man something, And Jesus is the fulfillment of that man's promise. That's exactly right. One more comment back here and we'll look at it. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Great point. So let's take a look at what's there. So I'm in Matthew 1, and he said, the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. So there's his claim. If you want to know what Matthew's entire gospel is about, you just saw it. Jesus, the Messiah. Jesus, the one sent from heaven. So how are you going to prove that, Matthew? Well, first of all, I want you to know that he is the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then he talks about a lot of names that we know really, really well through this period. You have Abraham in verse 2. You have David again in verse 6. And it leads all the way up to Joseph. This is making that connection. What is the great promise that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12? What did God tell Abraham? In your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Matthew's effectively saying Jesus is that seed. Through Abraham came Jesus. Jesus is Abraham's seed. He goes through some of these names. We have some interesting ladies from the Old Testament like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba. But in verse 6, David, what great promise did God make to David in about 1000 BC? What did he tell David about his throne? One of your descendants will sit on the throne forever. Now later it said, not in Judah anymore, but in a way that can never be diminished. And so they would remember, and it's the alliteration that helps me remember, 2 Samuel 7. In 2 Samuel 7, David was told that one of yours would rule forever. So these genealogies are doing a couple of things. They're showing this is the Jesus we're talking about. Let's not have any confusion here. It's a pretty common name. We're talking about the one who came through Abraham. He came through David. He also came through Judah. That's significant as well because it sets up the rule. Now in verse 17 it says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. From the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, he's using that language again, the Messiah, 14 generations. Now I've read about this, that this is debatable. That you might find 17 generations over there or 15 generations over there. But I don't think he's writing this to give you every family name. What he's creating is sort of a memory device so that no matter when you needed to do it, if you're a Jew in the first century, you could tie Jesus to David and to Abraham. Anytime. Anybody says, which Jesus are you talking about? You'd say, the father of, 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 and you would track them very easily. And so to do that, he came up with 14 between Abraham and David, 14 from David to Babylon, and 14 from Babylon down. So the genealogies, while for us, are kind of a boring read. You know, we kind of fly over them. Don't forget that Matthew's going to prove Jesus, and the first thing is he proves who he is and where he came from. And they would have known the promises. 2 Samuel 7 and Genesis 12, they would have known those by heart. That Abraham's seed and David's line would rule. This is the one. Now then he does something else. Look at a larger portion. This is going to lead up a little bit to our text. Our study is chapters 5, 6, and 7. This is my favorite part, unique part to the Gospel of Matthew. Mark and Luke and John, they all do this to some degree. But Matthew uses prophecy to prove Jesus. We've proven genealogy. Now watch this. Let me show you some of these. Look in chapter 1, verse 22. Verse 21. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Now all this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. Now, I don't know what kind of a Bible you have just yet. I haven't peered around just yet. But in my Bible, when it's in all caps, it means it's a reference to an Old Testament verse. Yours may be in italics, or it may be sort of indented. But do you have something there that shows you that verse 23 is an Old Testament quote? Okay. Now, find that in your margin. Where does that quote come from? Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. That's 700 years before Jesus came. Matthew is about to formulate an argument, the prophecy argument. And to be honest with you, I think it is the most powerful argument that exists on the face of the earth. I tell people this at times. If my daughter's 14, she's doing wonderfully. I'm very proud of her. But if she came to me one day and said, Chris, or Dad, she better say Dad. But if she said, Chris, I know I'm in trouble. I don't want to be a Christian anymore. I don't believe it. I don't want to serve God. I believe my answer would be, I don't know what it really would be. Maybe I may throw things. But what I believe my answer would be is I can respect your decision. If you can answer the prophets, if you can answer how all of these things were uniquely said hundreds of years before Jesus was born, we thank Alexander the Great for making sure that all that Old Testament was perfectly put together and put in a library 300 years before Jesus got here. You tell me how that happened, and I'll learn to live with this. There will never be an argument for your faith as strong as the empty tomb and the prophets. Now, guess what Matthew's going to use in his letter? Both. You get to the end, guess what it says? Matthew 28 and verse 6 says, He is not here, He is risen, just as He said. He's going to use the empty tomb. But he starts by saying, let me just hit you with a few prophecies. So, go into chapter 2, just keep going. In chapter 2, we have, now Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. Verse 3, when Herod heard this, he was troubled. Verse 4, gathering together all the chief priests and scribes, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For this, Matthew writes, is what has been written by the prophet. Verse 6, and you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. All right, where's that from? An Old Testament quote. Jews would have known it well. Now it's an Old Testament quote. Is that from Micah chapter 5? Verse 5, Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. He reaches back 700 years and he says he would be born out of Bethlehem. So now he's giving you two arguments. He said, first of all, he was born of a virgin, just like Isaiah said. He came out of Bethlehem, just like Micah said. Now go down to verse 14. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother while it was still night, and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt I called my son. Where's that from? Hosea. So now we're about 600 years before Christ. Now those are kind of confusing out of context. How did he come out of Bethlehem and out of Egypt and out of Nazareth? Is that even possible? It's possible in the context. In the context of it all, we have him, verse 6, born in Bethlehem, and then he goes to Egypt because of Herod's rage, and so he's in Egypt until Herod dies. And in a minute, you're going to see something about Nazareth. Look at verse 23. They came and lived in the city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets. He shall be called a Nazarene. Where's that from? Actually tricked you there. That's not an actual direct quote from an Old Testament author. This is probably Elijah. We'll give that one to him. He was an oral prophet. The point here is in verse 23, it was prophesied, though not a part of one of the letters of the prophets, but it's just more evidence. And I skipped one. Look in verse 17. What had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet. This was when Herod slayed all the male children who were in Bethlehem, verse 16. Verse 18, a voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Where's that from? That one's actually from the Old Testament. And in fact, even said so. So you see what Matthew's doing. He's saying, how can you deny my opening words? Jesus is the Messiah. His bloodline is perfect for the promises that God has made. And he is the fulfillment of dozens of unique and special promises that God made. You see another one? Look in chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. Now in those days, John the Baptist came, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is the one referred to by Isaiah the prophet when he said, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." Even John the Baptist's ministry was prophesied by Isaiah. Who else prophesied of John's coming? Malachi, the end of the Old Testament. The very end of the Old Testament said Elijah is coming. The Gospels say Elijah is here. So there's another one that we can add to that list. And we could keep going. Look, for instance, in chapter 4. We're almost up to the Sermon on the Mount. Not quite there. Look in chapter 4, verse 12. Now when Jesus heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and those who were sitting in the land of shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. Notice how Matthew's using these geographical prophecies, real practical ones. You know, they're not just philosophical. They're Zebulun and Naphtali, Egypt, Bethlehem, Nazareth. He's using unmistakable words that are uniquely fulfilled in Jesus. A really great exercise, and I know I'm just kind of loading a lot on you guys tonight. I mean, you're already going to preach a sermon to yourself this week and time it, right? And you're already going to look at the first couple of pages of the material, but something really, really rich. I used to preach to people that somewhere in your wallet or purse, you should have a half a dozen prophecies ready to go. Anywhere you are, any conversation you're having, anybody says, "I don't believe Jesus is the Son of God," you say, "Hold on just a second," and you pull it out and say, "In the Old Testament it said this, and Jesus did that. In the Old Testament said this, and Jesus did that." And have six of them ready to go anytime, and then maybe have a little Alexander the Great history or Alexandria library so you can show them, or maybe tease them and say, "If I can prove to you that these were written hundreds of years before this, will you come to church with me on Sunday?" But I don't say that anymore. You don't need the piece of paper. You don't need to put anything in your wallet or in your purse. You know what you need to do? You need to take a pencil, go through Matthew chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4, and write Prof 1, Prof 2, Prof 3, Prof 4, Prof 5, and Prof 6. You've got them. And you didn't come up with them, and you didn't have to figure out how to sequence them. You thought you might make a mistake. Matthew did it for you, guided by the perfect Holy Spirit. Just let Matthew do it. So now all you need is the Bible and the first four chapters of the New Testament, and you can make the most powerful argument known to man. And that's the power of prophecy. All right, any comments or questions about the prophecy stuff? How do we prove Jesus? We prove him through genealogy, connection to David and Abraham. We prove Jesus through half of a dozen unique prophecies, seven if you include the oral prophecy. And then we just say, hey, if you really want to be impressed with the guy, just listen to him preach. That ought to be enough. Even without the prophecies, I think I could just sit down once a month for the rest of the life God gives me and read the 12-hour sermon. Okay, that number was a little long, a little deep. It's going to be shorter than that. Every month I could read that sermon and be impressed with who Jesus is and who Jesus wants me to be. I hope there are at least 20 people in the room tonight who sat down here 20 minutes ago and said, "Sermon on the Mount." I mean, how many times have we read that? Couldn't you pick something, you know, different? I hope that's you. Because you're going to be blown away in this quarter. You think you've seen it, and you have seen it. But the more you go into it, and the more you take into it, like everything you already know about it, the more you take into it, the more you get to dig a little bit deeper and pull something else out. You want to prove Jesus? Sit down and listen to him. I'm so impressed by all my Facebook foes who know everything that's wrong with Jesus and have never read a word that he said. We need to look to the Bible. Then he says, all right, Matthew says, maybe that sermon had the power to change your life, but perhaps you're not yet quite impressed with my argument that Jesus is the Messiah. So how about this? Look in Matthew chapter 8 and 9. I want you to notice that sandwiched between the two strongest arguments on earth is our sermon. On one side, six prophecies. On the other side, incredible miracles. Undeniable, clear, instantaneous miracles done in the presence of men, written about in the very generation in which they occurred. Let's just find some. How many miracles do you see in Matthew 8? Point out one when you find one. I want to know how Matthew, of the hundreds of miracles Jesus did, how he carefully selected miracles to prove that he is the Messiah. What's in Matthew 8? He heals. The first story in verses 2 and 3 is Jesus' power over your body. Jesus heals the leper. Verse 13, Jesus heals the paralyzed without even being there. He didn't even have to be there to do this. Verse 14, Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law. Verse 16, Jesus performs many miracles, including power over the spiritual realm by casting out demons. He's illustrated power over the human body, he's illustrated power over distance, and he's illustrated power over the spiritual world. Chapter 8, there's something else. What else is in chapter 8? He's illustrated and proven power over this material realm. Jesus, I'm talking about Matthew chapter 8, about verse 26, Jesus calms the sea. Verse 32, he casts out the demons. So it's kind of like, where are you going to go to get away from Jesus? Probably wherever you go, you're planning on taking that body with you. He controls that thing. You might try to cover a little space and create a little Jonah distance. Jesus has power over space and distance. One day you'll leave this life and you'll go to a spiritual realm, but Jesus controls all that. He controls the extent to which the demons work. He controls the goodness and service of the ministering spirits. And wherever he tells your spirit to go, that's where it goes. And wherever you go in this life, the highest mountain, bottom of the sea, Jesus can level it. Jesus can raise it. He's illustrating his majesty. Chapter 9, he's just getting warmed up. Find a couple of miracles in chapter 9. What do you see? Verse 6, he heals the paraplegic, the paralytic in chapter 9 and verse 6. Move a little further. What else? Where are you looking at for that? Oh, yeah, no big deal. No big deal. We just raised the dead person. That's all. We just brought an inanimate dead person back to life. And that's found, of course, in verse 25. He took her hand. The girl got up. I think it's Luke 8 when Luke records this. I love Luke. Just give me Luke 8 and a soft heart and it's over with. And find some water. Luke 8 really puts this in a great little sequence. He heals a body. He calms the sea. He casts out the demons. He raises the girl. He controls yourself, your environment, the spiritual realm, and where you're going to spend your eternity. Matthew 8 and 9 and Luke 8. We also have the casting out of demons, verse 33. We have the healing of the two blind men, verse 29. We have verse 35. He was going through all the cities and villages. I'm in chapter 9, verse 35. Teaching and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So see what he did there. He concentrated his effort into two chapters. He's using chapters 8 and 9 to prove Jesus by miracles. Then I would say there's a really large section here where he just talks about the kingdom. Really what's happening is it kind of gets into the normal language of the rest of the Gospels. It's just telling the story. You know, you have to tell the story about him picking the disciples and traveling to the different regions and preaching and all these things. But what Matthew does unique to all the other Gospels, if you added up the word kingdom all the way through Matthew, all the way through Mark, and Luke and John, it would not occur as often as it occurs in Matthew. Matthew is about the kingdom. What it means to live under the rule of Jesus and be his church. What is that? What's that like? And so he tells these parables. Anybody remember any parables of the kingdom? Give me a kingdom parable. Kingdom may be compared to what? Say it again. Okay, the man who goes away and gives the talents and they do with it what they will while he's gone. The kingdom is compared to that. The kingdom, that's found in Matthew 25. The kingdom is compared to what? Give me another. Okay, the sowing of the seeds is compared to the laborers in the vineyard. I already burnt that sermon last month. It's compared to the man who finds the pearl, the man who finds the treasure. All these parables and stories about the kingdom, all of these are right in there. Chapters 10 through 25. Look in chapter 10, verse 7. chapter 10, verse 7. As you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. That was their topic. The disciples taught on the kingdom. We will be doing lots of kingdom study. If you love the Gospels and you love Jesus, you're going to love kingdom studies. What are we a part of? What does His rule do? And how do His people react to it? It's completely filled with that. You move all the way through to Matthew 24. Just sort of flipping through now. Matthew 24 and verse 14. Matthew 24 and 14. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Talking about the destruction of the Jerusalem that was coming. So here we are, a long ways away and a long time later, talking about the kingdom. Stories, the parables, the import. You might remember that kingdom's going to show up quite a bit in the Sermon on the Mount. Anybody remember any instances of that in the Sermon on the Mount? The prayer, right? The Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come. We'll talk about that. Kingdom occurs a handful of times there as well. So he's proving him through genealogies and prophecy and preaching and miracles, and then he just sort of talks about the kingdom. And then what comes last? Matthew chapters 26 through 28. What is the ultimate way to prove that Jesus is the Messiah? Yeah, the death, the burial, and the resurrection. He overcame the grave. I just have to tell you, you sit down at a table with any heart that has any softness at all, and Matthew can convert them to Christ. You may not be able to, and I may not be able to, but Matthew will convert them to Jesus. He opens right at the beginning in chapter 1, verse 1, and says, the Messiah. And then he goes about making sure that nobody ever forgets it. And then, of course, I already quoted it earlier, but Matthew 28, everybody has kind of a favorite Bible verse. I think we're allowed to have those if you kind of shift them around every couple of months. But right now, the one that impresses me the most are these three phrases in Matthew 28 and verse 6. The angel said, he is not here, he has risen. Just as he said. Now remember that the whole idea here is evidence. If Matthew writes this in the first century, all of the people who could have refuted this are still alive. If he's lying about any of it, it can be disproven. The providing of the body stops everything in its tracks. He even reveals the government conspiracy in chapter 27. He said, I'm going to tell you exactly what they did. They lost him. They lied about it. They paid some guys off. And you can go ask them. Anybody can paint that 1,500 years later and sell it. I'm not impressed with Da Vinci's stuff. But how about being right there in the very century, making the claim that no one for 2,000 years has been able to deny? I believe in Jesus. He is the Messiah. Now, if we can take that, hang on to it, we can take that into the Sermon on the Mount. He can change you. He can make you better. He can make me better because of who He is. That's all the time I have. We will pick up next Wednesday night with this material, so give it a look. Thank you.